Most historians of the American presidency, my next guest says, walking in lockstep with today's academic establishment, favor presidents who were big government statists and globalists. They dislike presidents who lowered taxes, protected American workers, and avoided getting the United States entangled in foreign conflicts that had nothing to do with protecting the American people. It's through that prism that they see all of America's history, he writes. Rating America's presidents, therefore, rates the presidents not on the basis of criteria developed by socialist internationalist historians, but on their fidelity to the United States Constitution and to the powers and limits to those powers of the president as delineated by the founding fathers. Rating America's presidents upends the conventional wisdom about a great deal of American history and present-day reality and is intended to do so. Robert Spencer offers what he believes should be the only criteria for rating the occupants of the White House. Were they good for America? Robert is next to offer what he believes should be that only criteria for rating the occupants of the White House. Again, were they good for America? That conversation is next on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Spencer is the director of Jihad Watch. He's a writer, researcher, and has written several books, as well as over 100 articles about jihad and Islamic terrorism. Previous titles include The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades. Robert has been studying Islamic theology, law, and history in depth since 1980. He's an adjunct fellow from the Free Congress Foundation and has consulted with the United States Central Command on Islam and Jihad, and has discussed jihad, Islam, and terrorism at a workshop sponsored by the U.S. State Department and the German Foreign Ministry. His latest, a bit of a departure, is Rating America's Presidents, an America First Look at Who is Best, Who is Overrated, and Who Was an Absolute Disaster. Robert, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
Just great. Thanks, Richard. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you. First, what do the founding documents tell us about the role of president? I think that's a good place to start before we start ranking them.
Yeah, that's very important because, of course, it's been almost completely forgotten nowadays. The president has actually just a few enumerated powers, and they are quite circumscribed, really. I mean, this is the whole idea of three branches of government, that each one of them checks the other. That is, that one of them is not able to exercise its power untrammeled and impose a tyranny on the American people. But the president's particular duties and responsibilities are to be commander-in-chief of the armed forces, and to conclude treaties with other countries as necessary. And really, essentially, that's about it. Otherwise, it says to give pardons and things like that that we actually think of nowadays as quite ancillary to what the president's primary duties are.
So explain how your ranking system works.
Yeah, you know, I was working primarily on the basis of what's actually encapsulated very neatly in the oath of office, that the president's primary responsibility is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So it seems like that's probably the best way to sum it up, that the president's responsibility is to make sure that the constitutional republic functions as it was intended to do by the founding fathers. And that is encapsulated even more succinctly in the phrase America First, which of course has been widely misunderstood, wildly misrepresented, in part because of historical circumstances, because of the development of the phrase, the use of the phrase itself in the past. But President Trump has stated it very clearly and neatly in saying, I'm not the president of the world, I'm the president of the United States. And in saying that what he means there in that is that his primary duty is to make sure that the American people are safe, prosperous, growing stronger, and so on, that the economy is improving and not regressing, that the American people are, their lot in life is improving in various ways, I'm not saying in that regard that that the government has to take care of our every need, quite the contrary, but that the president needs to be focused on the well-being of Americans and not on the well-being of people in other countries at the expense of Americans who have to pay and pour out our resources for the benefit of people in far-off lands for no clear goal or purpose and no good effect, ultimately.
So the ranking system works like this, zero being the worst, 10 being the best, but you can actually score, I guess, lower than zero. There are a few instances where presidents died very early on in office, in some cases just weeks after inauguration, so they really weren't given a ranking. Is that correct?
Well, really, there's just one, because William Henry Harrison, the ninth president, was president for only a month, and he was sick for most of that time. So really, there's not a single thing he did as president, and so I don't rank him. But James Garfield, who was shot, let's see, July, 4 months after he became president, and then he lingered on and died in September. He was shot in July 1881 and died in September. So he was president for about 6 months. I do actually rank him because there were several things that took place during his administration. So every president gets a ranking except Mr. Harrison for his month. And the scale goes from, as you said, from 0 to 10. I have four people in the number 10 ranking. So if I were remodeling Mount Rushmore, those four would be on it.
All right. I want to begin with the founding fathers. And the first five presidents really are the founders. George Washington, not surprisingly, he appears on virtually every list of the greatest presidents. Walk us through why what you gave Washington, and it's interesting because I think a lot of it had to do with not what he did in office, but what he didn't do.
Yes, George Washington, in a certain sense, defines what it means to be president, and he did that in a number of ways. In the first place, he asserted federal power. Now, that was vastly different from how federal power is asserted today. But what he did by putting down the Whiskey Rebellion and in some other actions was to make it clear that the federal government was a genuine entity and that it had actual power and was not just a paper authority or a figurehead office. And, of course, that has been decisive for the unity of the nation throughout history, much as federal power has been abused in the 20th century and 21st. But probably the main thing that he did that is lasting for the United States was actually leave office. He could have been president as long as he wanted. He could have been president until he died easily. He's still the only person to have been elected president unanimously, and he was elected unanimously twice. But he left office voluntarily. He relinquished it because he wanted to establish the principle that the American presidency was not something that should be pursued by people who had simply wanted power and would cling to it no matter what and in all circumstances, but that they would rather be focused on the well-being of the American people first and not on their own self-aggrandizement. And so they would relinquish power at a certain point, which, of course, Washington established as 8 years, became law later after Franklin Roosevelt became the first and only president to be in office longer than 8 years. But every other president before that respected the idea that laying down power at the end of two terms was a sign of the health of the American system, that we didn't have these time servers that we do now in the government at all levels that cling to power for decades, and people like Joe Biden, who was a senator and then vice president for 47 years and so on, and is now old and doddering and suffering from dementia and running for president, and Pelosi and the whole Democratic high command is about that old as well. Actually, Pelosi is older than Biden. And so you have.
Well, and to be fair, there are some career politicians on the Republican side as well.
Oh, there's no doubt. Trump is 74, but he hasn't been in government for decades, you know?
Right.
He just came in. It's not just a matter of age. It's been talking about. But you're right. The time serving is bipartisan, the clinging to power is bipartisan. this book is bipartisan in that it praises Republicans and Democrats alike when they're good for America, and it criticizes them when they're not. George W. Bush gets a very low rating, and some Democrats get relatively high ratings. But the point is that George Washington set the example in this, that the power should be actually exercised for the good of the people and not for the good of the person exercising the power.
So, and such was his popularity, he really could have been king, couldn't he have?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. He actually turned that down. That was offered to him, but he pointed out that they had just the colonists had just rebelled against a monarchy, and he didn't want to establish another. He wanted to establish a republic. Another thing he did was leave office in a rather penurious state. He did not enrich himself at the public trough. Nowadays, I think that's another very important example to recall in light of the fact that the six most the richest counties in the United States are all right around Washington, D.C. Now, you got to wonder, there's a whole lot of foreign money, a whole lot of lobbyist money being thrown around there that people are enriching themselves on. George Washington did not do that.
You also point out one of his notable accomplishments was establishing the cabinet and the federal judicial system. So it seems like a lot of the checks and balances weren't really even in place when he became president. Did he ever use that to his advantage? In other words, did he ever exceed the limits of the executive branch?
No, he was never accused of such a thing. But of course, you're absolutely right. These things were not completely delineated at that point. He did a lot to do so by establishing those things. And then we see that the system as we take it for granted now was still not fully understood or delineated, articulated clearly. We see that in the administration of his successor, John Adams, because Adams advocated for and exercised the Sedition Act, which essentially criminalized criticism of John Adams. And that was a direct contravention of the First Amendment, but it was judicial review as a principle, the idea that the Supreme Court could examine and strike down laws if they were unconstitutional. That didn't come about until a few years after Adams left office. So he was able to get the Sedition Act going and act upon it, even though it was plainly unconstitutional.
Right. So here we have one of the founding fathers, often lionized, as many of the founding fathers are, John Adams, second president. You give him a 4, and your evaluation, harmful for America, but also did some good. Also, by all accounts, not a very likable person.
No, indeed. He even confesses that himself to his wife, writing that he was obnoxious and disliked and so on. And he, of course, was friends with Thomas Jefferson, and then they had a famous falling out and perhaps an even more famous reconciliation later. Their letters back and forth are monuments of American literature and very important historically. But the thing about Adams is that, like several of the early presidents, the founders were better founders than they were presidents. Washington accepted. When you get to Adams, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, you've got people whose presidencies were quite flawed in many ways. But the actions that they undertook in order to establish the independence of the United States, to articulate the principles of the new nation, and to establish the government of the new nation, that was an achievement unparalleled in world history. And so I have tremendous respect for John Adams. John Adams is one of the greatest men who ever lived. But as president of the United States, it was not his shining moment.
Although he did avoid war with France.
Yeah, well, like I say, I didn't give him a 0. I didn't give him a 1 because his presidency was to some degree a mixed bag. Of course, nowadays, President Trump has quite rightly criticized the endless wars that the United States has tended to get into since Korea and before that in some ways. These wars with no clear goal, no clear definition or purpose, and they just end up being endless boondoggles and drains on our resources. This kind of thing has always been a temptation, although we've never fallen prey to it so consistently as we have in recent decades. Now, John Adams, at the very beginning of the American Republic, when there was tremendous tension with France, he avoided war. That was a war that probably was unwinnable, and we don't like to think about the possibility of losing wars, but it could have been quite disastrous for the United States to get involved in a war with France at that time. And so Adams is certainly to be commended for that.
Thomas Jefferson, this one was a bit of a surprise for me, and maybe it was for you too, after you delved into the career of President Jefferson. He's often heralded as one of the greatest presidents of all time, and yet you give him, it's a reasonable grade. It's a passing mark. It's a 7, though. Jefferson gets a 7. Where did he fall short in your estimation?
Well, I think, for one thing, the embargo that he tried to impose, that he did impose, on Britain and France. Britain and France were warring with each other at that time and preying upon American shipping. And Jefferson knew that war with either one could be disastrous for the United States. So he rejected, rightly, calls from various factions inside the United States that we side with one or the other and join the war. And instead, he forbade American ships to take cargo to Europe and closed American ports to foreign ships, which he meant to do to compel the two belligerents, Britain and France, faced with the loss of American trade, to stop attacking American ships. But as it turned out, they didn't really need the trade with the United States as much as we needed them. In those days, the United States was not the economic powerhouse, the colossus of the world that it is today, of course. And so the Embargo Act only ended up plunging the United States into a depression and impoverishing numerous Americans. And so that was a bit of overreach and arrogance on his part that was unfortunate. He's on Mount Rushmore, and I mentioned that I have my own Mount Rushmore. I would not have put him on it, but I understand that he's on it, but I would suggest that he's there more for his actions as a founding father, as the author of the Declaration of Independence, and so on, than he is as because of his presidency.
We're coming up against a break here at the bottom of the hour. I want to continue to talk about Jefferson a little bit, because when I think of Jefferson, I also think of the Louisiana Purchase, acquiring just an enormous chunk of land for something like 3 cents on the acre that dramatically increased the territory of the United States. And as we find out, you sort of give him credit for that, but also he gets some demerit points for the Louisiana Purchase. And we will get into that in just a moment. Robert Spencer, my guest, and the book is Rating America's Presidents. And very quickly, Robert, how do we get a hold of the book?
It's at Amazon. It's at Barnes & Noble. And if there are any brick-and-mortar bookstores still out there, it should be at them, or you can order it.
Terrific. All right. We'll take a quick time out, come back, and delve further into Thomas Jefferson, some of the other founding fathers, and we'll get to as many of the presidents as we can right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett. Earlier this month, scientists announced the surprising discovery of phosphine on Venus. This compound of phosphorus and hydrogen could be associated with life. While efforts to confirm the finding via observations from Earth or even fortuitously planned spacecraft flybys are underway, archived data from a decades-old NASA mission to Venus may have been hiding much sought-after verification in plain sight, with potentially more revelations to come. And you can read more about this exciting discovery in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. We are ranking the U.S. presidents tonight on Coast to Coast AM. More in a moment. Robert Spencer is here, Rating America's Presidents. Robert, we were talking about Thomas Jefferson before the break, and I mentioned the Louisiana Purchase. You say that sort of works both for him and against him in terms of his ranking. What was the downside of the Louisiana Purchase?
The downside comes from a strict constructionist standpoint, that the Constitution doesn't explicitly say that the president can make a deal to acquire territory. Now, you might think that's obvious. That ought to, who else can do it? But the Constitution does specifically say in the 10th Amendment that what is not specifically enumerated as a power of the president in the Constitution is reserved to the states or the people. So you could argue that it was up to the states and that there should have been conventions of the various states and voting in the states, perhaps, over whether the Louisiana Purchase was going to go through or not. Jefferson was working rather from the opposite principle that if it's not mentioned in the Constitution, then the president can do it. Now, it wasn't so bad. It was actually very good that he acquired the Louisiana Purchase and opened up the West to the United States. Otherwise, we would be a smaller, drastically smaller country along the eastern seaboard. But the fact is that he made it was a very bad precedent because he's opening the door to all sorts of things being found in the Constitution or the president doing all sorts of things that aren't mentioned in the Constitution because it doesn't specifically say he can't.
Although hard to imagine the United States today without the Louisiana Purchase.
Sure. And I'm not saying the Louisiana Purchase was a bad idea or something like that. But Jefferson himself wanted a constitutional amendment that would have granted the president the power to do this. And I would have been all for that. It never happened, but maybe it ought to have. Maybe it would have prevented some of the imaginative uses of the Constitution that we've seen in the last 100 years that have where we've seen presidents as well as Congress depart drastically from what the Constitution actually says of their duties.
Now, lest anyone thinks this is a partisan survey by Robert Spencer, the first Democrat president, Old Hickory, Andrew Jackson, the seventh president, gets an 8, and your evaluation, very good for America. Now, first, let's talk a little bit about the similarities between him and the current president. Donald Trump seems to have an affinity for Andrew Jackson, and there are some similarities there, aren't there?
Oh, yeah, quite so. Jackson was the first populist president, the first man of the people who was president. Before him, every president was from Virginia, except for two who were from Massachusetts and were father and son. And so the presidency had actually been, in a very real sense, the property of two oligarchies, rich planters from Virginia on the one hand and aristocrats from Massachusetts on the other. So Andrew Jackson was a man who was born in the backwoods and who rose in the ranks of the military and then entered politics. He was a real man of the people in the sense of not being rich, not being powerful, not being aristocratic or influential in that way. He was not, in other words, one of the elites. And so there was incredible exhilaration, joy, when he was inaugurated president. There were all sorts of common folk came to the White House and were celebrating the Washington powered elites were just absolutely aghast at this. But you see the parallels that the President Trump has, in his inauguration, said that he was taking the government away from the elites and giving it back to the people. And that's really why he's faced so much opposition, so much determined and frenzied opposition from the deep state, the entrenched bureaucracy in Washington, as well as from the Democratic Party, but also from the media. These people see their power as being threatened because they have been exercising untrammeled power now for decades, and he threatens it in just the same way that Jackson threatened the power of the elites of his day.
One of his noted accomplishments, rather, is killing the bank. Explain, because this was a charter for something like a precursor to the Federal Reserve, right? This was a foreign-owned central bank, is that right?
Yeah, it was a privately owned central bank that held the public funds, held the United States funds. And so the potential for abuse right there is obvious, that you've got some private individuals very rich individuals holding control over the Treasury of the United States. And they were able to buy influence, and they did buy influence. They were able to give loans, so-called, to politicians, and then the politicians would do their bidding. They were, in other words, an unelected, unaccountable oligarchy that was exercising tremendous power in the United States without being accountable to the voters. Jackson recognized this in a way that many of his contemporaries did not. This was the controversy over the bank was something that raged all through the pre-war period for, up until the presidency of John Tyler, when pretty much was put to rest. But this was an ongoing controversy, and Jackson understood what the stakes were in ways that are kind of reminiscent of Trump. He said to Vice President Martin Van Buren, who succeeded him, the bank is trying to kill me, but I will kill it. And I thought, when I was putting this book together, I thought, well, that's kind of like the deep state nowadays, that it's trying to kill the president, and we can only hope that he will kill it. But Jackson did kill it. He refused to renew the charter for the bank, and it died, although there were attempts to revive it after that. But Jackson acted against the bank because he understood the dangers of having so much power concentrated in an entity that had no accountability.
And after he killed the bank, didn't he pay off the entire debt of the United States?
Yes. And so that's another extraordinary thing. And that's one that we've completely forgotten about nowadays with the spiraling debt. We can only hope the economy will turn around sufficiently to render the whole question of the debt moot. But it used to be, in the early days of the Republic, it was a tremendous virtue to not spend more than we had. And, you know, you'd think that this would be taken for granted today. But I think that people have grown accustomed with the whole credit system that our economy is based on today to the idea that there's no real problem with going into massive debt. Jackson thought otherwise, and he kept America fiscally sound.
Now, you list as one of his notable accomplishments the removal of Indian tribes to the West, which, of course, today we look as one of the black marks on his presidency. So
yes,
why is that one of his notable accomplishments?
Well, let me make that very clear. The heading is actually notable accomplishments and events during his presidency. Let me get the exact words here, because just a second, I have the book in front of me. Notable accomplishments and events of his presidency, yes. And so a listing in that is just the main things that happened during the presidency. It's not a statement that everything in that section is good. And I'm not saying that the removal of the Indians was a good thing, not by any stretch of the imagination. However, it has to be noted that Jackson's intent in moving the Indians from the eastern seaboard to Oklahoma was not some genocidal aspiration or some desire to harm them. What he actually stated to Congress when he was explaining this policy was that it has become abundantly clear, and there's no doubt anybody who reads the histories of these days will see it. It had become abundantly clear that large numbers of the Indians had no interest in becoming Americans and taking part in the society of the United States. And so there was either going to be perpetual war or separation. And so he proposed separation. Now, of course, the Oklahoma as Indian territory didn't last, and there were many deals that were reneged upon, and that is the responsibility of those who reneged upon them. But Jackson himself, his intent was not insidious or evil or malicious. The fact is, however, that it was on his watch that the thing started, and meant it was adequate provision had not been made to take care of all these people as they were moving, and so many of them died, and that's his responsibility. So this is decidedly a mixed bag, but it's not the incipient genocide that some irresponsible historians have painted it out to be.
You mentioned John Tyler earlier, and this is a president that history has kind of forgotten. We don't hear a lot about John Tyler. He served but one term. He started out as a Democrat, and you give him an 8. Why is John Tyler deserving out of an 8 out of 10?
Well, John Tyler killed the bank again when there were attempts to revive it, and he did it at the expense of his own political career. It's rare that you find a politician who's willing to stand on principle even when it harms him personally. And so John Tyler is to be commended for that to a tremendous degree. What happened was John Tyler broke, he was a Democrat, as you noted, and he broke with Jackson over the nullification controversy when South Carolina declared that it had the states had the power to nullify federal laws they didn't like, and Jackson was threatening to send federal troops. John Tyler was a big states' rights advocate. He later actually became a Confederate senator, and he thought that was terrible that Jackson was talking about sending federal troops to a state. So he broke with the Democrats and joined the Whig Party, which was the opposition party of the day. And the thing was, though, that he still held many Democrat positions, including being opposed to the bank. And the Whigs were very split on the bank. So when they made Tyler their vice presidential candidate in 1840, he was balancing the ticket because William Henry Harrison, the presidential candidate, was considered to be pro-bank, although really he hadn't taken any positions at all. And Tyler was anti-bank. But the Whigs still figured, well, he's the Whig leadership that was against the bank still figured he's in the party. We understand there are people who are against the bank in the party, but we figure he will still do our bidding. When he became president, when Harrison died, he vetoed efforts to reestablish the bank that were put forward by the leadership of his own party. And they were appalled. They actually expelled him from the party. He's still the only president to be expelled from his political party while he was president. Although you could say that Trump certainly has de facto been expelled from the Bush-McCain-Romney Republican Party. There's obviously another wing. But in any case, Tyler took that, and Tyler stood his ground when it would have been easy for him to capitulate to the leaders of his party and recharter the bank. And then he might have been elected president in his own right in 1844. But instead, he stood on principle. We need more politicians who stand on principle.
I want to jump ahead to Abraham Lincoln, 16th president. And again, one of the presidents, I think, that unanimously appears on all of these surveys and polls of the greatest presidents. You and I talked before, and you admitted that before you sort of really delved into Lincoln, you were prepared to give him a very low mark, and then you ended up giving him a 10. We just have about 4 minutes before the break. Just begin to walk me through that process of sort of your coming around to, believing that President Lincoln was a great president.
Well, what I was working from when I thought that he was going to end up with a poor rating was the fact that he also, like Jefferson that we discussed before, contravened the letter of the Constitution, particularly in suspending habeas corpus so that he could imprison people without charge in Maryland, which prevented Maryland from seceding. And I thought, well, that's massive executive overreach, and executive overreach is the bane of our day nowadays, so I can't give Lincoln high marks for that. But the more I delved into it, the more I realized that he really he did what he had to do under the circumstances, and what he did actually does have constitutional warrant, because the Constitution does say that the habeas corpus can be suspended in times of insurrection. And it's just the only distinction is that it says that Congress can suspend habeas corpus. Well, Congress was not in session. Congress didn't stay in Washington all year round in those days. So Congress was not in session. He had the choice of letting the Union fall apart and being able to discharge his duty to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, or to act in lieu of the action of Congress in this case. And he did, and then he got Congress to deliberate and give him the approval for it afterward. Now, you could say, well, that's hollow because they couldn't possibly disapprove. Well, actually, they could have, because if they had gone on record saying that he should not have done that, it would have severely restricted his movements later on in the war and may have changed the outcome even at that point.
We've just got about a minute here, but he's also been criticized, widely criticized by some historians for attacking the press, sending goons in to smash up printing presses. Is there any truth to that?
I didn't encounter anything like that when I was working on this. Now, of course, there's voluminous literature, and it may be that it happened. Certainly, we know that there were attacks of that kind in Kansas before the war. And I actually wouldn't be surprised if there were some instances of things like that during the Civil War that were probably justified as wartime measures. You know, the problem is with war, when you're in a war, things get very messy. Like, people still argue, should Harry Truman have dropped the bomb or not? And we can argue that later on. But the fact is that when you've got a war going on, then it's not so easy to maintain the moral niceties that you might want to maintain in times of peace. And it would be easy for
Indeed.
Me to stand here in my office right now talking to you and say, yes, he shouldn't have done that if he did. Like I say, I didn't find record of it, but I'm not saying it doesn't exist. It's easy for us from the vantage point of 150 years later in the comfort of our existence to judge him for that. But in war, it's not so
okay.
easy.
Okay, I've got to take a time out, Robert. Back with more of my conversation with Robert Spencer when Coast to Coast AM continues.